for masks weren't necessary, to a single mask wasn't adequate. From a vaccine that would prevent infection to a vaccine that reduced severity of the disease. And as goalposts were moving, different viewpoints were being crushed. At the very moment when outside-the-box thinking was required, the internet could have been used by practicing physicians to share their experiences as they developed effective therapies. The internet was used instead to censor discussion and vilify anyone with a different opinion. Until COVID, a fundamental principle of medicine was early detection, allowed for early treatment, which produced better results. 2 years into the pandemic, the compassionless guideline from the NIH, if you test positive, is to essentially do nothing. Go home, isolate yourself in fear, and pray you don't require hospitalization. It has also been sound medical advice when dealing with a serious illness to get a second opinion, maybe even a third. Today is about getting that long overdue second opinion. So just a couple of housekeeping items here. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming to the event here in person. I want to thank the news outlets that are live streaming this, OAN, Rumble. But in particular, I want to thank the courageous doctors who have shown the compassion to actually treat patients, to struggle to provide the information there that is being kept from the American public, and suffer the vilification, the censorship, the suppression, the termination, the lawsuits that has come with their courage. Now, one thing I hope everybody realizes how highly qualified this panel is. I intended, quite honestly, for this event to hold no more than a half a dozen. But it was pretty hard to turn down the offers of eminently qualified individuals coming here to share their information, their opinion with the American public. So just so you understand how I met these individuals. Very early on in the pandemic, I was witnessing videos being posted by other courageous doctors that were thinking outside the box and coming up with a different theory of what this disease really was. They started posting their videos, and those videos started being taken down. And somehow, I really don't know how, I got involved in, connected to a group of global doctors and medical researchers on a number of different email sites. And I rarely chimed in, but I was just listening to the flourishing of information, the sharing of different studies, completely different from what I was hearing in the mainstream media. I'm not quite sure how all these experts came together. I'm hoping to ask them, they can kind of tell us exactly how that happened. But again, I just want to thank them for being doctors, for being medical research, for being medical researchers, for being academicians that have had the courage to withstand all the criticism. Now, I do want to point out that we invited folks from the other side of the narrative. Federal health agencies, their heads, or some representative from them. The CEOs or some representative from the vaccine manufacturers. They decided not to show up, which I think is somewhat telling, but also very disappointing. Now, I do have, I want to report that one individual I invited was Dr. John Raymond from the Medical College of Wisconsin. And Dr. Raymond, again, this was short notice. I don't blame him for not being able to disrupt his schedule and be able to travel here right away. But he was at least courteous enough to send me a letter, which I will enter into my own personal record on our website. I just want to read two of the 10 points that he made. The second point is what we need to do is to holistically evaluate our strengths and gaps in medicine, science, society, and policy with humility, integrity, and curiosity so that our next public health response is efficient, is seamless, and inextricably integrates decisions about human health, our economy, the needs of our communities, and the future of our children. This third point is for each of us, none excluded, to openly, honestly, and with respect and compassion explore how, where, and why the roots of division are springing up within our nation, our communities, and our institutions. I don't think there's an American that can disagree with what Dr. Raymond wrote. And I also have to say this is exactly what we are attempting to do here today. So again, I want to thank Dr. Raymond. Sorry he couldn't come here today. What I'm hoping is that we can assemble probably not as large a panel because a lot of these folks are in here for the anti-mandate rally, but maybe a few of you would come to Wisconsin and sit down and actually have a discussion in an open dialogue, an honest dialogue, because I think that'd be very important for not only the folks in Wisconsin, but for the American public. Now, the way this event is going to unfold is I've asked each of the presenters to provide an opening statement. I was quite adamant about keeping it to 400 words, so this should move pretty quickly. Following that, we'll have an open, pretty free-flowing discussion. I've got a bunch of questions. They will question each other. We'll have opportunity for the press to ask questions. We'll have some opportunity for some members of the audience also to step forward because the other people we have the opportunity to have them here. We also have the opportunity for the viewing audience to ask questions through our Rumble webpage. Now, for the audience, I do want, and I'm telling everybody, keep your answers, keep your statements succinct. There's a lot of ground to cover here. And Dr. McCulloch will be my co-moderator here, and we'll try and keep this going as quickly as possible. So with that, I think we should start the opening statements, and we'll start with Dr. Peter McCulloch. By the way, I asked everybody to submit their bios in 75 words. Their qualifications are so extensive, it was very difficult for many of them. I apologize, I've cut them down to 75 words, but you can kind of fill in some of the gaps. But Dr. Peter McCulloch is an internist, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and a leader in the medical response of the COVID-19 disaster. He published Pathophysiological Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2 Infection, the first multi-drug protocol for ambulatory patients infected with SARS-CoV-2 in the American Journal of Medicine, which he subsequently updated in reviews in cardiovascular medicine. He has more than 650 PubMed listings, 52 on COVID-19, and has commented extensively on the medical response. And again, this just barely scratches the surface of Dr. McCullough's qualifications. So, Dr. McCullough.
You're listening to this panel discussion that was held on Monday in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. We'll come back and continue with comments from Dr. Peter McCullough when Crosstalk continues. Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, author and seminar speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, how many different races of men are there?
Actually, Chris, the Bible never uses the term race, except when it talks about the human race. Biblically, we all go back to Noah and we all go back to Adam. We're all descended from them and related to all the people of the earth. And you know, this is exactly what genetic studies of the different ethnic groups is showing. Every ethnic group is so genetically similar to the others that it's like we're all from the same family, almost clones. Chris, notice how well this evidence lines up with what the Bible has to say. We don't use scientific evidence to prove the Bible, but we can, by using the evidence, show just how right that Bible is. Aren't you glad we can go back to Genesis and get it right?
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Call us at 800-628-7640 and mention the promo code FACT.
We're back on the VCY America Radio Network. This past Monday's panel discussion, COVID-19, a second opinion, the focus today and tomorrow, as we most likely cannot get all of this information to you in just one program. We hope you are taking some notes. We hope this information will motivate you to ask questions and reach out to others with the information provided. Just before the break, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin introduced Dr. Peter McAuliffe. There is where we will now resume.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to present now for a second time in the U.S. Senate. And I have organized my comments along the four pillars of pandemic response. I presented this to America November 19th, 2020, in the Department of Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Early Treatment. That was one of two historic Senate subcommittee hearings led by Senator Ron Johnson. And in that hearing, I presented the concept that our country should have always had a balanced approach to responding to the pandemic along four major principles. The first is to limit the spread of the virus. We quickly learned that this virus was a respiratory virus, that it spread from someone who is sick with symptoms to someone who's susceptible, who could actually acquire the infection, and they themselves become symptomatic. We learned early on that the virus is not spread from an asymptomatic person to another asymptomatic person. It was always symptomatic to susceptible person. And for those reasons, we had an opportunity on contagion control, but our efforts to do so were extremely limited. You can see the type of effort to limit the spread of control regarding hand sanitizer. It's not a hand infection. We quickly learned that it's not a hand infection. It's not spread by hands or pizza boxes or other objects. It was actually spread by an aerosol in the air. And later on in this proceedings, we've asked Dr. Bhattacharya from Stanford to present a brief video on the Great Barrington Declaration, because he led that effort with others that addressed some fundamentals on pillar number one. Pillar number two is the pillar of early treatment. And I think everyone in this room could understand there are only two bad outcomes with COVID-19, hospitalization and death. And if everybody in this room and everyone in the nation understood that they could get a respiratory illness and survive it in the comfort of their own home, assisted by medications in some individuals who were at high risk for that outcome, they could get along with that and understand that America would get through this illness together. And as we sit here today, there are 217,000 papers in the peer-reviewed published literature in PubMed. 94,000 of them deal with hospitalization and death as an outcome and in hospital treatment. 26,279 deal with vaccines, and 1,417 deal with treatment. And a small fraction of that is early treatment. We're going to hear from experts today on the principles of early treatment based on drugs used in combination with a signal of benefit and acceptable safety to be used under the guidance of the precautionary principle that this is a mass casualty event and we cannot wait for large randomized trials that are not forthcoming. And we certainly can't wait for guidelines that depend on those randomized trials. The third pillar is hospital care. We are going to hear today from experts who have a tremendous experience, some in the outpatient and the inpatient realm in the continuum of care, and others exclusively on inpatient care. But I can tell you, as a doctor making an observation, being in a large academic medical center currently in Dallas, Texas, but also throughout my career, to this day, we're 2 years into the pandemic, there is not a single hospital in America that is holding itself out as a center of excellence for the treatment of COVID-19. Yet those same very medical centers hold themselves out as experts in cardiovascular care or cancer care. There's still not a single academic medical center there in the United States today that has an early treatment program or even has continuity of care of patients going from the outpatient to the inpatient and back to the outpatient realm. The fourth pillar is vaccination. And vaccination, as we see it today, has been the central effort of our federal relief in COVID-19. And we're going to have a very careful review of vaccination. In fact, mass discrimination, another term that applies to that is indiscriminate vaccination. Now, I can tell you, speaking for the doctors around this table, we widely use vaccines as part of our clinical practice. This is a part of medicine. It is a standard accepted part of medicine. We have over 70 vaccines that are used in clinical practice, and they do work to help prevent the binary outcome of getting a disease, particularly a disease that is a low prevalence disease or a disease that one yet has not acquired. But never in human history have we widely applied vaccinations into the middle of a widely prevalent pandemic where people are falling ill, recovering, and falling ill again. And we will hear about vaccines and their role in pandemic response. So I've set the table. These are the four pillars of pandemic response, and I'll turn it back over to Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. Our next presenter is Dr. Ryan Cole. Dr. Cole is CEO and Medical Director of Cole Diagnostic, serves clinicians throughout Idaho and the nation with expert pathology diagnoses and patient-centered care. Dr. Cole completed his residency in anatomic and clinical pathology at the Mayo Clinic, where he was chief fellow during his surgical pathology fellowship, followed by a year as chief fellow at the Ackerman Academy of Dermatopathology in New York City, on the direction of world-renowned dermatopathologist, the late A. Bernard Ackerman. Having seen over a 500,000 pathology cases in his practice, he is uniquely suited to provide answers quickly and accurately, and I apologize for mispronouncing all these medical terms. Dr. Cole.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you to my esteemed colleagues, and I must commend you at pronouncing those actually quite well, so thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'd like to start really quick with a story. So a high-risk individual approaches me, 50 years old, obese, type 1 diabetic, calls me, I have COVID. This was about a year ago. What do I do? Help. Help. I'm going to the ER. My oxygen's 86. I have excruciating pain in my lungs. So I said, you're going to the pharmacy. Don't go to the ER. I called in some early treatment medications of the drugs which shall not be named. Said individual calls me a couple hours later and says, you know that excruciating 9 out of 10 lung pain, it's now 2 out of 10, 6 hours later. Well, I know the mechanisms of the medication I prescribed. A few hours later, and the next morning, he calls me, he says, you know that oxygen saturation of 86, it's now 98%. I said, isn't that fantastic? Early treatment works. That individual is my brother. I am my brother's keeper. Now, this virus we have known, as much as we've been told, it's a novel virus. Viruses are novel. This is 80% similar to a virus we experienced 2 decades ago. There's not a whole lot novel about this, other than the fact that a few sequences are different. But we're physicians and scientists, and we understand virology. We understand how disease works. So an upper respiratory infection, a virus, will replicate in the body for only about a week. At that point, you only have residual parts of the virus. So these tests that pick up, oh, you're positive still. No, those are the car parts, not the car anymore. So we have a week of intervention to where we can maybe try to intervene and stop the viral replication. Beyond that, we're really just spitting in the wind. Beyond that, then the virus and the phase of the disease becomes an inflammatory one, and we know with this particular disease, a clotting one. Well, in medicine, for eons, we have known how to treat inflammation and clotting. So the simple construct or the simple concept that there's nothing we can do, go home, let your lips turn blue, is a false construct. It just takes the will to say, we're smart individuals. I sit here with an esteemed team of bipartisan colleagues from all walks of medicine and politics and life that are highly intelligent, that know how to treat a simple upper respiratory infection, and the things, the sequelae that happen after the virus is replicated. So yes, I am my brother's keeper. Yes, I am a scientist. Yes, you're privileged, and I'm honored to be in a room of such intelligent people that know that there is treatment for this disease. Early treatment saves lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cole. Our next presenter is Dr. Harvey Risch. Dr. Risch is a professor of epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. He has been a university epidemiologist for more than 40 years and is a fellow of the American College of Epidemiology and a member of the Connecticut Academy of Science and Engineering. After getting his MD degree, he completed a PhD in mathematical modeling of infectious epidemics. He has published more than 400 scientific research papers that have been cited more than 44,000 times. I just quick little aside here. Dr. Risch and Dr. McCullough joined me with Dr. George Fried, who can't be with us today, in November of 2020 in my first hearing on early treatment. Following that, the New York Times published an article, a column written by the Democrat witness of that hearing, Dr. Ashish Jha, who had never treated a COVID patient. I actually read an article later. He holed up in his apartment for like over a year until he got a vaccine. But the New York Times titled that paper or that column, "The Snake Oil Salesman of the Senate." I want people to know that because as you listen to Dr. McCullough, as you listen to Dr. Risch, ask yourself, do they really seem to be snake oil salesmen to you? They seem to be eminently qualified professionals that, again, in Dr. McCullough's case, has had the courage and compassion to actually treat COVID patients. Dr. Risch.
Thank you, Senator, colleagues, listeners. It's my honor to be addressing you today and to answer questions later. We heard at the beginning of the pandemic that one of the medications that has been used in early treatment, hydroxychloroquine, or HCQ, was a game changer and would be effective in the treatment of COVID outpatients starting during the first few days of the illness. And then we heard study after study and media report after media report saying that HCQ doesn't work. These negative claims continued for months until the media got bored with all this and then acted as if the case were closed. However, this was a sham. The media reports never covered how the negative studies were actually fake studies. Well, they did cover the Surgisphere fraud, with the study that was published that was retracted, but that managed to change the WHO's policy before it got retracted. And the media never covered how the randomized trials that were put out that were supposedly informative about the lack of benefit of hydroxychloroquine had hid their positive results, were designed for low-risk people who never had any real risk for hospitalization or death outcomes, were not blinded, or had no idea who their internet participants really were, or any of the other numerous flaws that made them essentially irrelevant.
COVID-19, a second opinion. The focus today from Monday's panel discussion held in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Due to the wealth of information given over 5 hours, we will be continuing the information not only today, but tomorrow, God willing. Now, if you would like to see this entire presentation, go online and visit rumble.com. Rumble.com and search for COVID-19 Second Opinion. While not available from us in its entirety, we will have today and tomorrow's programs available for free download at crosstalkamerica.org or for a CD copy, you may call 1-800-729-9829. Stay with us. One of the prevalent conflicts in society is the battle over gender and marriage. We are flooded with stories pertaining to drag queen story hours, the restroom debates, gender reassignment surgeries, pronoun identification, biological males on female athletic teams, and so much more. These issues are not only confronting schools and businesses, but they have also encroached inside the church. Many are left wondering how to deal with these matters. The book, The Marriage and Gender War, addresses these issues head-on by using the absolute standard for morality as found in God's Word and is edited by Bodie Hodge and Ken Ham. The book is designed to equip students, parents, Christian leaders, and others to uphold the truths of Scripture on these critical issues. The Gender and Marriage War is available for a donation of $16 by calling VCY at 1-800-729-9829. COVID-19, a second opinion. The panel discussion held this past Monday in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. We're not surprised if you have not heard about this ultra-informative meeting. Thus, our efforts to bring you the information that you may make decisions for yourself and therefore also share the information with others. On the panel were several world-renowned doctors and medical experts, all to provide a different perspective on the global pandemic response, the current state of knowledge of early and hospital treatment, vaccine efficacy and safety, what went right, what went wrong, what should we do now, and what needs to be addressed for the long term. Just before the break, Senator Johnson introduced us to Dr. Harvey Risch, who was explaining what he called a sham in the response to positive virus treatment with HCQ.
The media reports never covered how the negative studies were actually fake studies. Well, they did cover the Surgisphere fraud, with the study that was published that was retracted, but that managed to change the WHO's policy before it got retracted. And the media never covered how the randomized trials that were put out that were supposedly informative about the lack of benefit of hydroxychloroquine had hid their positive results, were designed for low-risk people who never had any real risk for hospitalization or death outcomes, were not blinded, or had no idea who their internet participants really were, or any of the other numerous flaws that made them essentially irrelevant. And the media studiously avoided covering the 10 proper trials of hydroxychloroquine outpatient use that showed significant benefit for hospitalization and mortality. And just as a quick aside, the top two figures are for hydroxychloroquine for hospitalization risk and mortality risk. To the left of the vertical line means benefit. The diamond means how big the range of possible values are. There's very significant 50% reduced risk for hospitalization, 75% reduced risk of mortality. And just for comparison, you can see very similar results for ivermectin in the bottom two trials. Okay, this is real evidence. This is real scientific evidence. Now, the media has not reported any of these studies, but that does not make them non-existent. These studies involved, the hydroxychloroquine studies, involved more than 40,000 patients, including nationwide studies in two countries. So we see here that early hydroxychloroquine use dramatically reduces the risk of hospitalization and mortality. Now, we could later or never, if you want, discuss randomized versus non-randomized trials, the scientific issues involved in that. But what you've seen here is essentially scientific proof. Given that, why aren't doctors across the U.S. actually prescribing hydroxychloroquine as part of early outpatient treatment? Well, in fact, early in 2020, doctors did start using hydroxychloroquine in outpatients. But this was short-circuited by an act of FDA and BARDA employees to use the emergency use authorization regulations to block hydroxychloroquine use in outpatients, except in randomized trials. And these trials that are the same ones that would be cut off by participant fear because of the Surgisphere papers. And then the FDA mounted its biggest fraud of all time by putting up this warning. This warning says, FDA cautions against the use of hydroxychloroquine in outpatients outside of the hospital setting. But then, in the justification, it says, we base this on information to treat hospitalized patients. Hospital disease, as we'll hear, and as we know from 2 years of dealing with COVID, is a completely different illness treated with different drugs, different medications in the hospital. Outpatient disease is flu-like. Hospital disease is a florid pneumonia. And so the fact that the FDA would base recommendations and warnings on hospital disease, which is a totally different disease than outpatient disease, is a fraud. This website is still there today and constitutes an outright fraud. Okay? This basically scared everyone across the country against using this on the basis of this fraudulent website. Now, Senator Johnson has twice demanded from the FDA in writing to release the data that they relied upon to make this claim that of warning, and twice the FDA has refused. So at this point, we know it works. We have lots of medicines, not just hydroxychloroquine, not just ivermectin for that matter, that need to be used, and the FDA has to be held accountable for this website. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Risch. We're going to change the order a little bit. We're going to go to Pierre Corey first, then to you, Dr. Parks. The reason I want to go to Dr. Corey first is to just point out, I didn't say this initially, but the viewpoints expressed by all these individuals are their viewpoints. One thing I've certainly noticed as being part of this group is they don't all agree.
Sometimes they disagree quite strenuously.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Again, I'll point out there's so much we don't know. I would have liked to have seen a much larger dose of modesty coming out of our federal health officials and the legacy media and big tech when it came to we would be so much better off if there was robust debate and discussion. These are two individuals that differ slightly in terms of what drug they prefer. So let me go to Dr. Pierre Corey. He's a pulmonary and critical care medicine specialist and a former associate professor and chief of the critical care service at the University of Wisconsin, which is how I first noticed him. During COVID, he co-founded and serves as the president and chief medical officer of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to developing effective treatment protocols. He has published over 10 peer-reviewed manuscripts on COVID-19 and is considered one of the world's clinical experts on the role of ivermectin in early treatments. As a further introduction, I did become aware of Dr. Corey early in the pandemic. As I would put on my first hearing, to just put things in perspective, we had Johnny Anitas, so we had a bunch of Emily-qualified individuals just talking about this disease versus others in terms of mortality rates, that type of thing. But a few days before the hearing, I heard of Dr. Corey and his groups recommending corticosteroids as an in-hospital treatment, and it intrigued me, so I invited him. He testified virtually as we were doing back in May. I had doctors come up to me afterwards, crediting me with saving their patient's life because they had listened to Dr. Corey. Six, 7 months later, after the New York Times called these gentlemen and me, snake oil salesman in the Senate, didn't deter me, I had Dr. Corey come back and talk about his group's work on ivermectin. His impassioned opening statement, which I think was prompted by my ranking member's insults, basically called him a partisan hack, but in Senate speak, diplomatically, fired him up, and he offered an impassioned opening statement, which was viewed by 8 million people on YouTube before it was taken down and censored. So without further ado, Dr. Corey.
So I'm really tired of watching the U.S. health system's failed response to this pandemic. I cannot list, and I do not have the time today to talk about the innumerable failed policy responses. Some of them are so obscene, absurd, illogical, and non-scientific that they're almost unspeakable. Things like, if you guys remember, not testing the vaccinated. Things like not recommending vitamin D, not checking vitamin D levels. I mean, things that are so fundamental, basic about science and medicine, and that they've been avoided. And I have to say, I'm going to call it out, and I'm known for this. I call it like I see it. I'm calling attention to the corruption. If you look at these innumerable failed policies, there's only one way to understand them. They are literally written by pharmaceutical companies. Almost every single policy serves the interest of a pharmaceutical company. However, if you look outside the United States and look around the world, there have been numerous successes. As one of the world experts on ivermectin, let me just talk about some programs which used ivermectin. My colleagues here, as Dr. Risch just pointed out, there are a number of compounds that we've identified that are effective in early treatment. Almost all of them are repurposed or generic. But let me just say a few words about ivermectin and what it's doing around the world. Not in the United States. In the United States, it's a horse dewormer, it's horse paste, and only the illiterate, ignorant, and or unvaccinated use it. But let's talk about some of those successful programs. Number one, across the world, there have been programs by health ministries which employed either widespread distribution or test-and-treat programs. I'm going to list them for you today. Listen well. That medication has been shown to literally solve the pandemic in numerous regions around the world. Mexico City, December of 2020. their state health system deployed an early test and treat program. They deployed 250 mobile testing units throughout Mexico City, and they had treatment kits. They used and they collected data on 120,000 people. 50,000 of them took treatment kits, and they found in those who were given treatment kits that up to 75% avoided hospitalization. Up to 75% avoided hospitalization. Their hospitals emptied. Argentina, La Misiones, another health ministry, early test and treat with significant dosing for five-day strategy. They found that over 4,000 patients, again, 75% reduction in the need for hospitalization and an 88% reduction in death. They were avoiding hospitalization and avoiding dying. The miracle of Uttar Pradesh, which is not covered in any newspaper in almost any country around the world. They literally eradicated COVID from its borders. It's a poor state in northern India, using 70,000 healthcare workers distributed across the country or their state. They visited 97,000 villages. They tested early. They gave everyone ivermectin in early treatment. They gave household members ivermectin for prevention, and all of the healthcare workers took it. In September of 2021, they reported that in 67 of the 75 districts, there was not one active case. Their positivity rate in the previous 2.5 million tests was 0.007%, which is effectively zero. They eradicated COVID from their borders. This was not covered. This was not covered. Two newspapers in India covered this, and the word ivermectin was not mentioned. The Brazilian city of Itajaí, this is a paper that was published in the last 2 weeks. It is one of the most remarkable studies in the history of medicine because it included complete data on 160,000 people in the city of Itajaí, where that health ministry in June of 2020 offered its entire citizens inhabitants the opportunity to take ivermectin as a preventative. 113,000 people decided to, and something around 50,000 did not. And when you compared the two groups, even though the group that elected to take it was sicker, older, more overweight, much more disease, they got the disease 50% less. They went to the hospital 68% less, and they died 70% less often. It is a truly remarkable study using immense amounts of data. La Pampas, Argentina, same thing. Early test and treat program showing that the need for ICU or death fell by 50 and 60%. Peru did mass distributions long ago in 2020 until they stopped doing it because the administration changed. But they showed in all of the reasons where they did mass distributions, mortality rates and case counts fell. It is a highly effective medicine. Even in Japan, the president of the Tokyo Medical Association announced to all doctors during a summer surge that they should use ivermectin in the treatment. Within weeks, the hospitalization rates reported out of Japan were lower than at any other time in the pandemic. That medication works. And when you deploy an early test and treat strategy, you can cure and solve this pandemic. That information is being buried.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewreport.com. Are we on the verge of World War III? Former CIA analyst Dr. Peter Vincent Pry was recently on my radio broadcast warning about that. What's going on? Well, Russia does not want Ukraine to join NATO. They don't want to see a NATO alliance nation that close to Moscow. And they have a history of being invaded from that direction, and so they're quite nervous. Of course, unnecessarily, but they're nervous. You also have generals who keep messing up our foreign policy, like in Afghanistan. And many of them, they get promoted during war. Then you have the military-industrial complex. And then you have the reported money paid to the Biden family by Ukraine. So indeed, Biden may need a safe face and defend Ukraine if he wants to keep getting money, as he's supposedly doing, from other people, other nations. There are a lot of reasons that World War III could happen. Stay tuned.
Final segment for today, COVID-19, a second opinion, will continue, God willing, tomorrow, as there is still so much information to get out. Just before the break, Dr. Pierre Corey speaking about ivermectin as treatment.
That medication works. And when you deploy an early test and treat strategy, you can cure and solve this pandemic. That information is being buried. Why is that happening, you might ask? I'm going to say that what I've just reported today, that information is being suppressed across most of the world. United States health agency structures and policies created over the last 50 years, the pharmaceutical industry with public health institutions, resulting in repeated policies placing pharmaceutical industry interests ahead of the welfare of U.S. citizens. The industry's capture of our health agencies, combined with their increasing financial control of most major media, social media, and medical journals, has led to an ability to widely suppress and or distort any information which supports the efficacy of repurposed, low-cost, off-patent medicines. This war has been going on for decades, and this decades-long war on repurposed drugs waged with the ever-present goal of protecting the market for novel, patented, obscenely profitable, and often barely tested and toxic medications, has reached a pinnacle in COVID-19. It's an absurdity, it's an obscenity, and it's a crime. It has to stop. The impacts of their disinformation war on repurposed medicine now constitute crimes against humanity, given the global morbidity, mortality, and loss of social, societal, and economic liberties that could have been avoided if such information would have been widely disseminated.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Next presenter will be Dr. Richard Urso. Dr. Urso is a medical doctor and scientist who graduated AOA with highest honors from the University of Texas School of Medicine. He continued with 5 years of postgraduate training and research is the sole inventor of an FDA-approved wound-healing drug. He's gone on to repurpose many other medications for usage in scarring, wound healing, inflammation, and viral infection. He is the former chief of orbital oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. He's been involved in COVID-19 since March 2020, discussing pandemic response, and he has treated over 1,600 COVID patients. A quick, Dr. Urso, I've always thought of you as an ophthalmologist, correct? I always was wondering, what was an ophthalmologist treating adult COVID patients?
But yeah, that's a great question. So I'll get to that. I'll weave that into the story because I think a really positive message. So it's been a great tragedy these last 2 years, but it really didn't have to be that way. Really, I would say with my esteemed colleagues here, thank you for all of you have sort of influenced a lot of my thinking. And I think all of us will say that we have this. We know how to treat diseases. So COVID-19, the novel coronavirus, right from the get-go, I spent 9 years in a tissue culture lab doing inflammation scarring tumor virus work. I really just looked at it. Okay, it's a respiratory virus. What do we know about respiratory viruses? We know that respiratory viruses live about 5 to 7 days. So I was, as I looked at this, I thought, well, that's probably going to be true for this virus. We didn't have it cultured yet, but as it turned out, in the first year of culturing the virus, I don't think any live virus was cultured past 8 days. It was usually about 5-6 days. So that held true. So back in March of 2020, a bunch of my colleagues, we assembled, we started looking at options of what we can do. And it became quite evident after talking to people in Italy and South Korea and elsewhere that it was a respiratory virus that was going to be causing a lot of inflammation. And then one of the unique things that was happening here, this respiratory virus for a coronavirus was causing a lot of blood clotting. So you had respiratory distress, blood clotting, and inflammation. And so as a physician, those are easy conditions to treat. The difficult part was really attacking the virus. And at the time that I first looked, again in March, early March 2020, I found about 8 things that might work based on mechanisms. And so I think these are, like, in a sense, tools in the toolbox that we ought to be trying. So my first patient, I treated with hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, vitamin D, aspirin, and steroids. And I literally was shocked when I went and talked about it that that people were really coming at me about the steroids, because anybody who treats respiratory syncytial virus and other viruses, the inflammatory phase is typically one of the most important phases. And of course, when Dr. Corey came out and said that, he was attacked mercilessly too. But to anybody who treats disease,
It really, to me, I was kind of surprised to get attacked. I was getting attacked by people who really didn't know what they were talking about. So what I'll say is, you, as people who are listening, it's an inflammatory disease. It's a blood clotting disease. We have lots of medicines for inflammation. Why would you not treat inflammation as an outpatient? We have so many different drugs. Why would you not treat blood clotting? We have every... Who gets admitted to the hospital for blood clotting? Maybe a day or two, and then you go back out. There's lots of things we have. Attacking the virus, you have to do that in the first week. And what has happened? We actually have drugs like remdesivir, which are being applied day 15 and 20. They have no chance of working. It's a one-trick pony. It has to work when the virus is replicating. So at that point, what I tell people is the problem is these drugs are... Viruses and cancer cells are unique. They use our own machinery. So if you're not killing the virus, you're killing something. You're killing our mitochondria. You're killing our cells. So these are just strategies that it doesn't take a lot of thinking. As a physician, I literally am shocked to see people using these drugs, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 weeks later. They can't work. So at the end of the day, I think the message that I kind of want to send is, as Dr. Cole said earlier, the virus isn't killing people. It's in a sense, you know, it's the viral particles creating the inflammation, creating the blood clots, the cars versus the car parts. So it's not dying from the cars, you're dying from the car parts. And we've had this the whole time, and I want to make one more, which I think is an important point. I would tell everybody, you can take any two drugs away, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and still save almost all the lives. And that's the end message. We can beat this disease. I'll give you one more.
It was held this past Monday in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Senator Ron Johnson assembled a panel of the world-renowned to discuss a second opinion on COVID-19. We haven't even scratched the surface on the 5 hours of content that has been made available. You can watch this in its entirety. Visit Ron Johnson's website, ronjohnson.senate.gov. ronjohnson.senate.gov. This has also been available on Rumble and even YouTube for now. God willing, we will continue sharing the information here tomorrow. Today's Crosstalk is being made available for a free download. Visit our website, crosstalkamerica.org. CD copies are available when you call 1-800-729-9829. For Jim Schneider, Dalton Windsor's.